Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is our friend and a man I much admire, New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, sir.
Alan, great to be back with you.
Hey, I hear you just got back from Bangladesh. What were you doing over there?
Well, it was a very interesting and challenging visit. Stuart Applebaum, who's head of the Retail Workers Union, RWDSU, convened a delegation of union members, largely RW members, and Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's head of Catholic Charities for the New York Archdiocese. And myself, from the perspective of not only government, but from being an investor with our pension fund and some of the big, you know, fashion brands that we're all familiar with, who contract with factories that produce the garments that many of us wear. And as you know, there have been some real tragedies there from a worker safety point of view. The Rana Plaza factory collapse, over 1,100 workers killed in that tragedy, the Tarzine fire and other factory fires that also others have been injured or killed. In many ways, it harkens back to where New York was at with the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire, where 146 largely immigrant, largely women, and that's the same profile of the workforce in terms of women in Bangladesh. And it was really a fact-finding opportunity and a way for us to elevate the discussion of what responsibility the companies we invest in have for ensuring that those who they contract with at the factory level in Bangladesh, what they need to do to upgrade their building and safety code standards.
So what do you do? I mean, who do you talk to? Do you talk to the people who own the factories? Do you talk to the people who own the companies, the American companies that deal with the factories? How do you do that?
Well, actually, on our trip, we were supposed to meet with the factory owners. They have an association. They're very powerful there.
I'll bet they are.
Well, because that's the emerging part of the economy. Yes. I mean, they're really rapidly developing. That's the source of wealth. And it's interesting. So they have this clothing manufacturers, the Factory Owners Association. So they not only have economic power, they also are very well represented by their own members in the parliament. So one of the issues is the lack of adequate laws or enforcement of existing laws in Bangladesh. There's a lot of corruption in that country. So when we were there, there was also a political stalemate going on. You know, there's this power struggle between the current prime minister, the former prime minister. Their fathers were the prime ministers, and they have quite a history since they broke off from Pakistan and created independence. So there were blockades. There have been a series of strikes. Unlike what we do in Albany, they have blockades on roads, and they firebomb buses with people on them. So
were you scared?
You know, I was not prepared for the level of intensity of the blockade. We kind of heard that this was happening. We were actually having lunch one day at the hotel, and we heard some explosions. We were outside on the terrace, and we went to look over the railing. There was an attempted firebombing of a bus right in front of our hotel, and we were in one of the more secure and better areas of the city of Dhaka, the capital. The firebomber missed his mark, so there was just a gasoline stain in the road. But the day before, 18 people were killed in a bus from a firebombing. So that drove home the point. And when we went back and forth to the airport, we had, you know, someone with a rifle traveling with us in a bulletproof vest. I didn't have a bulletproof vest, but the security guy did. So it underscored that the overall landscape there is very much in turmoil. But we certainly don't want anybody to lose sight of the fact that these workers deserve greater protection. We met with some of the folks who survived the collapse of Rana Plaza. We met with a factory worker. She started working in her teens. I guess she was in her 20s now. She spent about 3 hours in the rubble, hearing the moans of her fellow workers just a few feet away from her who did not survive. She did. She had a number of operations, more surgeries to come. So who we talk to is trying to get the companies we invest in to talk to the folks in their supply chain, the factory owners, the contractors, subcontractors, to adhere to much more rigorous building and fire safety standards.
So what are you going to do now? Are you going to not put more money into Bangladeshi companies, or do you give them a chance to change their ways?
Well, you know, keep in mind, these are largely American and European countries, right?
Firms.
And they then contract with,
sure,
you know, because Bangladesh is rapidly becoming, it's now the second after China in terms of manufacture of ready-wear garments.
Because it's cheaper.
And they won the race to the bottom to having the cheapest labor pool.
Which they don't want to mess with, right?
Right.
In other words, if they mess with that, then the same thing that's happening with China, people go to another, another place.
Well, the way China's developing, I think they're happy to cede the space to Bangladesh. But Bangladesh doesn't want to lose it. I mean, they're going from tremendous poverty poverty to this creating jobs, but shouldn't be at the expense of the workers. So we are pressing the companies we invest in to do what we call sustainability reporting. How are you tracking not just your own corporate practices, but those who you contract with to produce the garments? And what's happening right now is that there are two camps that are forming. Largely European companies have joined together what they call the Accord on Building and Fire Safety Code Improvement. The American companies have formed the Alliance. There's some differences in how they approach it. We are identifying companies in our portfolio who are signed on to neither the Accord nor the Alliance. They haven't bought into the need for there to be better codes in terms of worker protection. So we're certainly encouraging them to be part of this, to be part of the improvement. And it all begins with transparency, reporting. What are the practices that you are encouraging because of the liability risk? Alan, as we've talked about on your show before, while we like to do good things, the bottom line for me is the fiduciary responsibility to the members in protecting our investment. And with these kinds of repeated injury and loss of life to workers, there's liability exposure, there's reputational exposure. So certainly our investments are not protected if this kind of situation continues to be tolerated. I also hope that American consumers will... I started looking at my labels. I was surprised how much of my clothing comes from Bangladesh.
Well, if it does, are you, Tom DiNapoli, are you less likely to buy something with that label?
Not necessarily, because you know we certainly want to see the improvement in quality of life for the workers there. But I am paying more attention as I learn which companies are instituting these best practices. I'm going to be a more discerning person in terms of looking at not just where is the garment manufactured, but what company is manufacturing, what label is on it, and is that fashion brand part of working for positive change there in Bangladesh?
Okay, that's a pretty complete report on that for now. Let's go on to your looking at the public authorities and how much they're paying their employees. And there have been some sort of shocking results coming out of this.
Well, as we've often talked about, the public authorities are really like the shadow government in New York
State. We're talking about things like the Port Authority.
Yep.
And
MTA, downstate is big. There are authorities all across our state. And no surprise, what you find is that levels of compensation, perks, bonuses, certainly salary, are typically higher.
Than government, regular
than
government
regular state agencies, yes. Yeah. The percentage of like 13% of public authority employees make $100,000 or more, whereas for state agencies, only like 8%. So we continue to want to shine in the spotlight. We don't feel there's adequate accountability in terms of how the authorities are spending money. And this report is one of a series of reports that we've been doing to let the public know what's happening with public authorities.
Now, if you had your way, Tom DiNapoli, would you say, enough with these authorities, let state government do its work, put transportation in transportation, you know, because we know what happens is that sometimes they spend money, these authorities, and it's off the books, and we don't really get a true picture of what the risk is.
And it's not only the spending, Alan, it's the borrowing. You know, we've raised a lot of issues about the backdoor. When's the last time people in New York voted on a bond proposition? It's all the borrowing's done now through these authorities. They're not going to go away. I don't want to be naive and say that, oh, well, you know, tomorrow we could do without them. And some of the authorities obviously provide very important services. But we have too many, and there isn't the adequate oversight of them. The governance, you tend to have boards that... very often have holdover appointments. You know, even the current administration may not be in control of the authority. So, we've in terms of governance structure, we've called for shorter terms of office, and so there could be more accountability, at least to whoever the governor may be.
So that would be up to the legislature, Tom, right?
Yeah. I think we need to continue to shine more spotlight. The legislature did give us a couple of years ago, and our friend Richard Broski was a big champion of this, more authority for the controller to review contracts of authorities over a certain amount, and we've been exercising that authority. So this is an area where we need to have more accountability, and we don't have enough right now.
Are you given enough money to do all these incredible tasks that you have to do? I mean, you really have a lot of work to do.
Well, you know, we can always use more resources, but I'm very cognizant of the fact that we're in a tough time in government right now, and every agency and every entity is being asked to tighten up. Certainly to the extent that we are the oversight office, we need to model best behavior as well. So, you know, the governor has asked for us to control our spending and our budgets, and we've been doing that year after year. Does it mean we could do everything in an as timely way as we'd like? No. I certainly could use more auditors. You know, we've been doing a lot on special education services and the ripoffs
and
we've found there. Yeah, but, you know, we could do just so much. Just like with the school accountability initiative a few years ago, where actually Governor Spitzer ensured, working with the legislature, we had more money for auditors. We'd like to see more help in that department. Why? When we can do audits and we can do recoveries for the state of millions of dollars, those investments and those audit services more than pay back.
And you can throw the crooks out.
And see it. We've had several criminal referrals and indictments. And, you know, so I think the accountability agenda of what the Comptroller's Office does is more important today than it's ever been, because everyone is so concerned about waste of taxpayer dollars.
So, Tom DiNapoli, how you doing in terms of the investments that you are putting into the stock market and other places? Would you say you're happy?
Yes. The short answer is yes. Certainly from where we were at a few years ago when the global financial crisis hit. We lost 26% value of our fund in 1 year. This past year, we value the fund on March 31st. We were at over $160 billion. We've never been at that high a figure. So that means
So you made all the 26 back that you lost?
We not only made it back. Keep in mind, you know, last year alone, we paid out over $9 billion in benefits. So we've been paying out all these benefit dollars, and yet we're still at an historic high.
Who makes the decisions about where to put the money?
Well, contrary to what some people think when they hear that I'm the trustee,
sole trustee.
Yeah,
right.
Sole trustee. I only like that
you
phrase.
Sit there, I can just see you with your eye shade sitting up there at night.
My Wall Street Journal, buy low, sell high, right? We have our chief investment officer, who's terrific. Vicki Fuller is our chief investment officer. She has a team, about 50 people that work in the pension fund on our staff. And then we have our consultants and advisors, and we obviously hire money managers who work with us. So there are internal and external checks and balances. I do the final sign-off on some of the investments, but we have a very rigorous process, especially with our alternative investments, real estate, private equity, those areas. So because of the volatility in the stock markets, we've been trying to diversify a little more within the legal constraints that we have. But the good news is real estate has come back. Private equity, I think, is doing pretty well. The public markets are certainly doing well. Where we have a real challenge is a big part of our portfolio is in fixed income. So because money is so cheap right now, obviously the fixed income portfolio is not producing, you know, outsized numbers by any means. So,
but that could change.
And the other parts of the portfolio make up for that. That's why you have diversification.
Sure.
You don't put all your money in one basket. A pension fund certainly can't do that. And we have the benefit of being a perpetual investor. We're going to be around forever. We could be very patient capital. And I think because we've had a rigorous commitment to our asset allocation that takes a long-term view, that's why we've been able to recover. And Alan, we continue to be the best funded of all the big state pension plans in the country, one of the best of all the 50 states.
What does that mean, best funded? In other words, you can stand behind your obligations.
Exactly right. So the problems you read about in Illinois that's been capturing the headlines, or even Jersey, Detroit, which is a city plan, we don't have those problems. We have more than enough money to pay our obligations.
Well, it sounds like, Don DiNapoli, sounds like you're doing extremely well, which is why I'm a little puzzled. I hear rumors that the governor's office, principally a guy named Lawski, Ben Lawski, are trying to take over the investment function. Now, if I'm the governor, I'd like to do that too. Sure, Tom DiNapoli has a lot of responsibility and a lot of power. So if I'm a governor, especially a governor who is looking to try to control everything, which is his rap sheet, then I want to take this away from you. This is a very serious situation as far as I'm concerned. How do you react, if at all?
Well, I read recently a sage Albany soothsayer had some prediction in this regard, and I would just say that independence of the controller's office, I think, is key, particularly with regard to managing.
That's why we have an independent control.
Right. Yeah. Independently elected. And we very strenuously guard that independence. That being said, there is an oversight role for the Department of Financial Services. Used to be the insurance department.
That's
Guy
Lawski.
Yep. No. We had worked with Eric DiNallo, who was the insurance superintendent at the time that I first came into office when Elliot Spitzer was governor. And we understood part of why what happened during the Hevesy administration happened is that the insurance department probably had not been as faithful to its oversight role. So we have been very much a part of revitalizing that role. That does not mean micromanaging our investment strategy. We just had an outside fiduciary review by Funston Advisory Services, gave us more than a clean bill of health with how we manage the pension fund. So we're going to certainly protect our interests, but we are going to certainly be cooperative with appropriate oversight for our responsibilities. I think that's something that the people of the state expect.
We got Olympics coming up in Russia, and as you know, Putin and some of his people have been displeasing the gay, lesbian, and transgender communities by some really homophobic activity and remarks. Is there a role you can play in this?
Yeah, well, terrible legislation enacted in Russia on the federal level basically infringes on the rights, particularly of free speech of gay and lesbians in gays and lesbians in Russia. And here they have this premier opportunity to showcase their country with the Olympics. And many people have been very upset about the situation there. I'm very concerned about our athletes that will be going there that may be gay and lesbian. How will they be treated there? As you know, there have been many voices, and certainly here in New York, Assemblyman Danny O'Donnell has been, and Senator Brad Hoyleman, leading the charge to say we should be doing something different and not just standing by idly. Some have called for divestment of our investments with companies that are involved with sponsoring the Olympics or companies that are operating in Russia. You know, we don't like to do divestment. That's a last resort because we're investors. We need to make money for our retirees and for taxpayers. But we certainly have the same concerns. So similar to what we talked about earlier with Bangladesh, we have reached out to the major corporations that are sponsoring the Olympics and called to their attention the fact that it's an unacceptable situation. Again, reputational risk to our investment. If you're invested in Coca-Cola, which obviously many people in their portfolio would be invested in Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola is sponsoring the Olympics, and there are consumer boycotts of that product in response to what's happening there in Russia, that could hurt our investment. So we feel we have an obligation to say, and I shouldn't pick on Coke, there are other companies as well.
No, but it's just an example.
It's an example. It's an example to make it real for people, to say, are you aware of what's happening in Russia? And are you raising your voice to suggest to the Russian Federation they need to revisit these new laws that they've enacted? What are you doing to ensure that your employees who may be there participating in the Olympics as a sponsor, that they're going to be protected and safe and not be harassed because of the environment there in Russia? And also, what are you doing to work with the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, to ensure that the athletes from all countries, regardless of sexual orientation, will be able to participate fully and not be subject to harassment or any kind of discrimination? The Olympics is supposed to be truly a level playing field, and these laws compromise that. And again, our concern is for the reputation of the corporations that are underwriting this. So we have written, along with John Liu, the city controller, and a number of other institutional investors, to companies that are part of the sponsorship to say, you need to look at this and you need to work with us in trying to change the climate there.
Okay, we only have 7 minutes to go, so I want to ask you some real fast questions, Tom. First of all, on the Moreland Act Commission, you know, the governor appointed this Moreland Act Commission that's supposed to look into, you know, the way in which the role money plays in politics. And one of their chief recommendations was to get rid of the State Board of Elections, which they say is doing a terrible job. You've been around politics for a while. What do you think?
Well, you know, there are a lot of issues with the State Board. I think part of it is a resource issue. I don't know they have the resources to do what they would like to do and what they need to do.
So the legislature starves them so they can't do too much.
Well, you know, probably in the scheme of things, if you're talking about money for a senior program or for schools or health care versus more money for the Board of Elections, what will be more popular with the folks back home?
Well, sure, but right? We're not talking about, you know.
Yeah, it's about huge amounts of money.
Yeah.
But so, I think in fairness, I'm not trying to defend the board where they've made mistakes or they haven't done an adequate job, but beefing up the responsibilities and the resources, I think, would certainly make sense. To me, the most important change, and I hope the Moreland recommendations will give more support for this, will be to have public financing of campaigns in New York. I think that's the essential.
You've always called for that.
Always.
And you've always said, if you want to make an experiment, start with me.
Start with the controller's office, the place that should be most above the political fray.
Yeah.
And obviously more limits on the amount of money that people spend. The amount of money is outrageous that we spend on elections.
So what about Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney down in the Southern District? He's talking about taking the pensions away from the political crooks who've gone to prison from the legislature.
Yeah.
It seems like a good idea.
I think he's on the right track. You know, he's taken a very bold position in this area. We've proposed state legislation that would enable us at the state level, and of course he's a federal prosecutor, to do something similar, to be able to attach to the pension benefits that are being paid out as part of not only restitution, but a penalty as well. So he's using the power of his office, and I think in an effective way. It sends a strong message. Don't think you're going to get away with it and then retire on a cushy pension. So it's a strong message that people need to see.
Can you take the money away from the guys who have already been convicted?
Well, you know, he's trying to do that basically to, you know, these are cases where there are fines or restitution,
right, sure.
So he's attaching to it. What I propose for the state level is for there to be an enhanced penalty. So it's even beyond the question of restitution. There would be a monetary penalty that would attach to the pension benefit. So it would be a way of getting the money back without violating the state constitutional protection, which is there for good reason, you know, for the everyday workers who, of course, play by the rules and don't violate the law like this.
What's Open Book New York?
That's our transparency initiative, and we've been building it and expanding it, taking all the data that we have on state spending, on state contracts, making it available for the public. We just had an enhancement. So in effect, you could look at the checkbook of the state of New York, see what kind of payments are being made. Yep.
So if I want to go
online to
Open Book New York.
.com.
Or just
put in your search engine, New York State Controller, and click on the Open Book icon.
So then anybody that New York State writes a check to, I'll be able to see?
Just about. I mean, there's certain privacy matters of, you know, depending on, you know, it's a personal information that, you know, we can't give out. But for payments to contractors and vendors, the typical kind of payments that someone might be interested in, that information is going to be readily accessible.
So if I wanted to compare, for example, the governor has about $30 million in his campaign account. Let's say I want to compare the people who gave him money and the people New York State has written checks to. Could I do that?
Well, it might take a little more work than just what's on our website. But if you had some other list that you want to compare payments to, you probably could.
It would be great if you have one of those sort of tools, you know, on your website. They do that at Tia Craft and other places. You have tools, and you say tools. Okay, Andrew Cuomo, $30 million. Compare the people who got the money and are giving the money. You see my point?
I can see you're in the holiday spirit, Alan. That you're just coming up.
You always think I'm throwing you fastballs and getting you into trouble.
You notice my voice is going, so I can't respond to that, right?
Okay. So you have been doing audits and showing repeated abuse for those working two or more public jobs. Uh-huh. What are you finding?
Well, dual employment, it's allowed, but you need, in many cases, approval. And certainly, if you're working at two jobs in the public sector, you have to make sure that you're adequately keeping track of your time, that you're not, in effect, being paid for being in two places at the same time. We did an audit of about six state agencies, and we found too many cases where it was really questionable that people seemed to be getting paid for work that they didn't do because they couldn't be in two places at once. It really called out for the need for there to be greater supervision of those who are doing a dual employment, make sure they have the appropriate approval, make sure that they are, in fact, working the two separate jobs, make sure that in terms of their ability to even do it, and make sure that they're not putting in excessive hours that would compromise their ability to do either job well. And fortunately, in this case, the agencies, instead of disagreeing with our recommendations, they embrace them. And we're going to see more tightening of the supervision of dual employment.
So you have university hospitals, for example, and a lot of these doctors, you couldn't have them working for the state university and for the hospitals unless they were also having clinical practices and other things. So I guess you got to be careful.
You have to be careful. But it all gets back to appropriate supervision, appropriate internal controls. So much of what we do with our audits, when we see a breakdown, we see a problem, you don't have the right internal controls. You don't have the right supervision. You don't have the right accountability in place. And our audits are meant to focus on agencies, on local governments, to tell them what they need to do to get it right.
And has the State University Foundation, has that been improving?
I think so. You know, we've done some audits in that area, and there's been a change in leadership there not so long ago.
Absolutely.
We're doing some more audits there as well. There is still a question about how the foundation operates. So we're continuing our oversight in that area. But I think some improvements have been made.
Tom DiNapoli, always great to talk to you. I could have asked you 1,000 more questions. Our guest has been Tom DiNapoli, the state controller. And that is the Capital Connection. And we're delighted that you all joined us. Thank you, Tom.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.